The final topic discussed by the think tank group was intermittent androgen deprivation, and Dr. Laurie Klotz began by discussing what we know about the use of this strategy in both PSA-only and metastatic disease.
We don't know too much. I mean, the data so far is that both those studies had a lot of patients with metastatic disease. No evidence of a difference. The downside, to my mind, in patients who have metastatic prostate cancer, particularly high risk with extensive disease, their off-treatment interval tends to be short, and I tend to discourage them from going on intermittent therapy. There doesn't seem to be much benefit of going off treatment since they're only off for a few months in most cases. So Dave's study is really going to answer that question.
Where are we with your
study? We should stop that study with all this data right now, right?
Can you talk a little bit about the design of the SWOG study, Dave, and where we are with that right now?
Well, it's patterned after a lot of the things that were developed in Canada and ideas about intermittent therapy. And we chose 9 months for induction for the reasons that Dr. Klotz has already mentioned, that when you androgen deprive somebody initially, you're going to see a PSA fall very rapidly, which doesn't totally reflect the reduction in tumor bulk right away, and it takes a little bit longer. So that's one thing. The restart time has been debated. In that study, I believe it's 20 or a doubling, and there are some people that get real, you know, having dealt, we have about 60 patients locally on the trial, and people get nervous about their PSA going up in the control arm. The study is almost complete.
What fraction have PSA-only disease versus METs?
They're all METs.
It's only
in
METs.
Our study.
Isn't this generally being used with PSA-only disease?
No. Yeah, it is, and they have a great study they've done in Canada with rising PSA. But let me say one thing that we've learned from this study, and that is that people that fail to knock their PSA down to low levels, i.e. even undetectable, have a very poor prognosis. As a matter of fact, if they fail to get their PSA down below 4, they have a 11-month survival rate, which is worse than hormone refractory disease. And you talk about somebody that ought to be studied, then, you know, Dr. Oh was telling us about all these. What we really need to do is we need to subclassify patients, and we need to do all this other stuff. And I agree with you. Molecularly characterize these people. Fine. But we got something simple. As Dr. Friedland already said, it's called PSA. That's very powerful in predicting who is not going to do well. Then we throw on top of that some other things that are pretty simple that any lab can do, like hemoglobin levels, and C-reactive protein, and then it gets more interesting in being able to dissect out who's not going to do well.
Steve, what about the issue of this strategy in PSA-only disease?
I'm not a huge fan of intermittent hormonal therapy, and I think Laurie kind of touched on why. In the man with the really rapid doubling time, the time he gets off therapy, and by off therapy, I don't mean the time where he's not getting an injection, the time he actually has a normal testosterone is extremely short. And so he actually derives relatively low benefit. I think the people that do get a significant quality of life benefit are the ones where when the testosterone comes back, they stay off therapy for a year or two. And in my experience, those are the patients with very long doubling times that I'm hesitant to use hormone therapy in the first place. So I think if you take all comers, there are some where intermittent would be better than continuous because they really don't need any treatment. And there's some that really need continuous. So if you take all comers, sure, you're going to see no difference between intermittent and continuous. But if you risk stratify, I think we can identify the group that really needs continuous and the group that probably doesn't need any.
Laurie?
We started a 100-patient prospective phase 2 study in about 1987. And it was actually just published in 2 publications. So it's a very mature study, and there's a lot in there that relates to both of these comments. First of all, one of the ironies is you can predict the off-treatment interval in part by the baseline PSA, and the patients who do best are the ones who have a baseline PSA below 10. Well, they're probably the ones who actually are being treated prematurely. So if you wait till the PSA is above 20, as per, you know, the Studer study, their off-treatment interval is much shorter. The second point, just to reiterate what Dave said, the PSA nadir is a huge predictor for the off-treatment interval and for time to androgen-independent progression. Even at the low levels, the difference between less than 0.2 and 0.2 to 0.4 sort of thing, the ones who achieve a detectable but low level, also have a much shorter off treatment.
We've known that for a long time. It wasn't our study that showed that. If you go back to the Anandron studies that were done years ago in Europe, I mean, we've known it, but we don't use it.
What about Steve's point, though, Laurie, about PSA-only disease? For example, a patient with a rapid doubling.
So to me, there's three groups of patients. There's the group who have the, like, Friedland bad actors, you know, with a doubling time less than 3 months or, say, less than 6 months, whatever. I think they should have continuous hormonal therapy. There's the group who have a very slow doubling time. They should have delayed hormone therapy, which could be intermittent. And then there's the group in the middle where you're kind of a little bit worried about them. And I think in those patients, I think relatively few patients should actually get lifelong hormonal therapy where they have long-term survival. So it's in those intermediate patients with a doubling time, say between 6 months and 15 months, where you think androgen deprivation therapy is warranted, but there's no benefit of long-term therapy, continuous, that's been demonstrated. So other than the patient with real bad disease, I typically don't continue it beyond a year or two.
Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think your point is well taken, Laurie, that there's probably are three groups, and it's that middle group that is kind of the conundrum. So my question is, what do you think about like a Casodex 150, kind of an alternative hormonal therapy that's somewhere in between doing nothing, and it's certainly closer to the continuous, something along that line.
So, yeah, I guess there's a little bit of a bias against it in Canada because it was taken off the market for toxicity. And
For men with watchful waiting and localized disease.
I'm just...
Right.
Yeah. But if that hadn't happened, it would probably be used a lot more. The issue with Casodex, I think it's got a role, but the gynecomastia is a problem. Mm. And patients really don't like it. The patients who I had on the large trial, number of them have required breast reduction surgery.
Do they have radiation in Canada?
I'll have to check that. They don't like to get, you know, you're offering radiation, it's their chest. They kind of weren't crazy about that either.
Matt, people don't like that. When I say, hey, you're going to get breast tenderness and enlargement, and they say, well, no, I'll just wait and see what happens. Then it's too late.
Yeah.
Then you've got tamoxifen you can use, but then you've got another drug.
Do you see any sort of obstacles in terms of radiation therapy? The patients don't like it, or are they usually okay with doing it?
I don't know what it is. It's just when you offer men this about, we're going to give you two zaps to your breast. It's not much at all. I don't know psychologically what it is, but maybe the radiation can answer that. It's hard to convince
men. It depends who offers it to them and how it's offered. It's like everything else. If you have a urologist who believes in cryosurgery as a good treatment for localized disease and is not a radiation fan, then the patient doesn't hear the same way. I mean, breast irradiation. Well, no, but breast irradiation.
I believe that's one place where radiation works.
Right.
Right.
So there you go. There's not too many therapies that we do for cancer patients that's less benign than breast radiation. If you can't argue somebody to get their breast irradiated, if they want to take a drug that might affect their survival, and you're talking about the toxicity of all everything else we do, you're not a good salesman. I think you're...
Let's ask... I'm just a country urologist from Denver, but let's ask some of these highfalutin guys from the East Coast, South Carolina. What happens there?
Tom?
With what? Radiation?
When they
for about
bring
breast
up the
radiation.
Idea, breast radiation.
Yeah, I mean, we offer it to patients if we use 150, but we don't often use 150. I mean, it's very rare.
You still
rare
get
now.
It with 50, though. You can still get breast enlargement.
Not to the same extent. You just don't see it nearly as much.
As monotherapy, but no one uses 50 as monotherapy, or they shouldn't.
There are people that do.
Around us.
I would point out that our patterns of care study, we asked if you were diagnosed with PSA-only relapse 2 years after radical prostatectomy that required hormone therapy and you had good erectile function at that point, what treatment would you prefer? And the number one choice is bicalutamide monotherapy. Although I don't know that that happens that much. Mary Ellen, does it happen?
Rarely offered.
It's usually driven by a patient who walks in with a strong bias towards focusing on the side effects and will use it, but usually driven by the patient. And we would radiate everyone's breasts. We don't have any trouble doing breast irradiation. In fact, the majority of our patients who get external beam radiation in 6 months of CAB get breast irradiation before starting.
But to me, the big draw is not erectile function in this population. It's bone mineral density preservation, which is enhanced. It's enhanced because of the elevated levels of estrogen. And we did a study of tamoxifen for prophylaxis in Canada. It works. It prevented.
It does work.
But it blocks the bone mineral density preservation is coming from the elevated levels of estrogen. You're giving an anti-estrogen. So you may be actually undermining the benefit of the drug with that prophylactic approach.
Tom?
Most people have, in the community anyway, have forgotten the Iverson data, which was, you know, very strong data when it came out, 6.4 years, the same as full-blown LHRH agonist therapy in M0 disease, which is essentially what we're talking about, is the rapidly rising PSA patient, and it really did have a use. And it's something that has been ignored because of the bias, I think, against biclutamide, but I certainly think it's an option, and I think it should be considered far more.
Dave?
Well, you mentioned the monotherapy. We started this probably 15 years ago, and Trachtenberg did the same thing with a low-dose anti-androgen, and then we added a 5-alpha-reductase inhibitor, and we have data out 15 years. Jed Mao started doing it, too. Well, just doing that for rising PSAs and having people just basically the only side effect is gynecomastia.
We have similar data, and actually there's a follow-up to that, which is that 100% of people who actually progress on anti-androgen monotherapy, this was a flutamide plus finasteride study, when they progressed, salvaged with LHRH agonists, 100% of them responded. And the response duration to the subsequent castration may have been perhaps shorter than otherwise expected, but was still substantial, a median of another year at that point. So I do think one of the problems with some of the early studies that compared combined androgen blockade to anti-androgen monotherapy was that they never really talked about a strategy for castrating men who progressed with the anti-androgen alone arm. I think the reason that people are reluctant to do it, even though all of us talk about the possible benefits, is that so far the data have generally shown that it's inferior when you compare them head-to-head in metastatic disease, even though the overall benefit is modest. And the other is that you can't really do it intermittently. Obviously, when you stop an anti-androgen, you know, these guys are full of testosterone, their T levels go up because you're blocking the receptor. And if you stop it, their PSAs just kind of skyrocket. It may come back down, but, you know, they don't like when you stop it. So you can't really do intermittent anti-androgen monotherapy. So the question for them is, if they have a rising PSA, should they stay on an anti-androgen kind of lifelong, or do they want to do now what appear to be short courses, 3 or 6 or 9 months of hormones with an LHRH agonist and stop?
When you stop it, quote, their PSA skyrocket, is that documented?
Well, it always goes up because, in general, what you've done is you've simply removed the blockade, and their testosterones are generally about 20 to 30% higher.
For how long?
It may be a flare effect. You mean, if you take it away, how long does it take before
How long is before their testosterone comes back down?
It's a good question. Most of my patients don't want to wait and see. So typically what we've done is I've never tried intermittent androgen ablation. I've generally stopped it in the setting of a patient whose PSA is rising on it. And then before starting an LHRH agonist, I'll say, let's just check another PSA to see what the change is. And almost universally, and this is not a large number because we, similar to you guys, don't treat a lot of patients like this, almost universally their PSAs are up 3 or 4 fold within the course of several weeks.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Anthony?
I would just bring up one other point. I know that Lori mentioned using a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor in the off period. There is basic science data now that even in the setting of hormone refractory disease, there are intraprostatic receptors that remain active that are still present, and it begs the concept of whether something that blocks intraprostatic receptors would be of any benefit in combination with what we currently use with hormonal therapy. I've never been a believer, because there's been no data, and there still isn't, of triple hormonal blockade. But this basic science data that suggests that there is still responsiveness inside the prostate to androgen blockade even after a person becomes, quote, hormone refractory is intriguing. I don't know if Dan or any of the medical oncologists know anything.
Well, Jack Shalkin brought that up last year at our think tank that we do.
Right.
Which is, you know, and that's not new, that Dr. Strum and some others have.
But there's no data driven there.
He's got 400 patients. I mean, it's.
Could I just ask, is anybody concerned about the fact that you're on intermittent androgen ablation and we accept 4 after 6 months of therapy as being a response? Because it bothers me when I look at somebody, okay, they may not have been up in the hundreds, but if you've had 6 months of therapy with proper LHRH plus an antiandrogen and your PSA is still 4, I'm rather concerned about that patient. I do not like that PSA, and I don't think that they should be included I think those patients are the group who we may need to be moving on to, at least calling them that they're now semi-refractory, if you like, because, again, getting back to the Dykeman data, the maximum benefit was shown when in the first 7 months the patient's PSA went down below 0.5. And that was the group who had the longest survival on CAB versus monotherapy. And I think the same may well hold true in this situation. It's only a month shorter, but I'm rather worried about a patient with a PSA of 4 after 6 months of MAB. Does anybody share the concerns?
Yeah, oh yeah, that, sure. That was the study design, which was probably...
But it's now in the German study as well. What's stopping people using going down to 0.5?
I mean, Maha's data showed that for those patients who didn't go below 4, it was a median survival of 13 months. I mean, that's worse than general hormone refractory disease.
Mm. Why is that?
It's like being hormone... You're really primary resistant to hormone. You're not really responding and then relapsing. So you're going
to
do...
You think
poorly.
These are people who have low testosterone to begin with, or is there... It doesn't seem to be just higher grade disease or
whatever is activating the androgen receptor is activating it earlier than classic hormone refractory disease.
And the same data exists in PSA only relapse, the same exact data that the PSA nadir value, and in fact even the time to the PSA nadir value are both prognostic and give very ominous outcomes in terms of cancer death if you don't nadir or if you nadir too quickly. So if you nadir at 4 and you do that in 2 months, you're worse off than if you nadir at 4 and do it in 9 months. So a shorter time or a higher nadir are both negative predictors.